Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. With a background in math and inclination to embrace complexity, Puneet Kohli has always found managing capital in the derivatives market both interesting and challenging. And at the Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan, Puneet is also finding meaning and purpose in his work. Sitting within the fixed income and derivatives team at HOOP, Puneet plays a role in delivering the pension promise for 350,000 frontline workers within the $110 billion defined benefit plan. In pursuing this, HOOP employs a derivative-centric risk management process that's quite sophisticated, more resembling a U.S. hedge fund than a U.S. pension fund. Through our conversation, we learn more about how Puneet thinks about capitalizing on risk dislocations, utilizing the edge in HOOP's long-dated capital and strong balance sheet, but also incorporating the lessons provided by markets that are subject to episodes of extreme volatility that result in significant liquidity shortfalls. With this in mind, we talk about liquidity management and also about playing defense through the search for negatively correlated assets. Here, Puneet discusses rate contingent puts on the S&P 500, a trade that embeds short equity, short bond, and long volatility exposures, all while achieving a healthy discount to vanilla put structures. Lastly, we reflect on market vol episodes, including the global financial crisis, the blow-ups experienced during March of 2020, and also the meme stock up crash of early 2021. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Puneet Kohli. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Puneet Kohli. He is an assistant vice president in fixed income derivatives at the Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan, also known as HOOP. Puneet, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Dean. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I mean, I've known you for a long time, and I look forward to having a free-flowing and entertaining discussion about the market.
We go back 20-odd years. One of our topics we'll dive into is the meme stock era and the volatility implications. But I think when we met, we were perhaps at the tail end of the first tech bubble, if I'm recalling correctly.
I was trying to think how long we've known each other, and I like saying I've been in the market for 20 years, but actually it's probably been a little bit longer. I think we've probably known each other for, it might be 25 years, which is kind of insane when you think about it.
It's a long time. Yeah, I think we were facing off on some of the earliest variant swaps in the business, and certainly on the single stock side, really, really early days. So it'll be fun to have this conversation looking back, and we'll certainly spend a lot of time assessing the here and now of risk. I know you, but in terms of our audience, let's get to know you better in terms of your career trajectory. How did you get your start? Tell us about the early days in the industry for you.
I can start kind of education and then kind of like my career history. I mean, for university, I went to the University of Toronto. I specialized in mathematics with majors and minors in statistics and actuarial science, respectively. I know that sounds really nerdy. Let me state that my first passion was and still is art. However, I decided early on that I'd like to eat. I mean, I saw many of my artist friends that were older than me, really good artists, graduate and struggle to make ends meet. So I decided to change my career path and pursue math, which is where I felt that I had a competitive advantage or an edge. And that really was kind of a first lesson or an early lesson that I learned. Figure out what's the edge. What's your edge in life? What's your edge in a trade? And if you can't find one, you might want to look a little harder or find something else. I deviated a bit from the question, but just get back to it. I graduated from University of Toronto, and then I worked in IT for 3 to 4 years, which I quickly realized that I didn't like. So I decided to pursue my MBA in finance. I enrolled part-time, switched to full-time about halfway through, completed my MBA, and got my first job in investments at the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. And that was the start of my investing career. And that's when we think we first started. And you're right, Ontario Teachers, when I was there, we did the first, not variant swap, actually it was volatility swap. And that was on the Canadian index, the TSX 30 and TSX 300, I believe. If my dates were right, I think it was like 1998. So it goes a long ways back. But at Ontario Teachers, like I said, I started as an analyst. I was in research and economics in their division. I was a junior in a team of very smart people, very senior people that pushed me in a lot of different directions. So I learned about fixed income and risk from Wayne Cozen, international equities and tactical asset allocation from Zen Freshman, economics from Leo the Beaver, and I mean, the list goes on. Some of these people are still active in investments today, and it was a great area to cut one's teeth. From there, I made an internal move to the equity and derivatives trading desk under Kevin Duggan, who gave me my first taste of trading risk and touching money, and I owe him for that. Actually, the funny thing is he hired me, and within a week or two, he left. So he didn't leave teachers, but he left me to run everything as he went on his honeymoon for 2 weeks. So for me, it was trial by fire. I was responsible for everything, asset rebalancing, trades for the portfolio managers, whether it was futures or individual stocks, basket trades. I survived and I came out better for it. Kevin and I had some great years together. We built a great team and made lots of money for the pensioners and the plan. From teachers, I left to run the U.S. Equity Derivatives Proprietary Desk at Bank of Montreal. So I was there for about 4 years, and then I left there to run an internal hedge fund for the National Bank of Canada. Louis Vachon, who was the previous CEO, and Ricardo Pasco, who was the CIO, hired me. So I started there with $40 million of seed capital, trading a relative value volatility fund. I grew that to $120 million in capital, and I started a second tail fund with $40 million of capital and grew that to $80 million. So at the peak, I was managing $200 million in capital, which was a good amount, especially since I had a direct drive deal, which is pretty much impossible to cut in today's day and age. And so I had experience on the buy side, experience on the sell side, banking and pension plans, and that has got me to where I am today at Hoop. At Hoop, I'm an assistant vice president at Hoop. I'm responsible for the development of investment programs to maximize the plan's return to risk profile. I started at Hoop focusing on volatility and derivatives in various asset classes across capital markets. My mandate includes various capital market strategies, internal risk-taking strategies. As well, I picked up various alternative strategies. So currently, many new alternative strategies roll under me, like insurance-linked securities, external managers, and quantitative investments. Let me also state that at Hoop's edge is that we have a very strong risk management team, a highly diversified portfolio, and an excellent investment team. So all of these factors have contributed to Hoop being a top-performing pension plan globally. I've been at Hoop for 9 years now, which is the longest I've ever stayed at a place. So you can say that I like it, and I do, partly because I am responsible for generating good investment returns, and I'm tasked with building new return-generating investment strategies, which I love, even though it's not easy in a challenging investing environment, but I'm more than up for the challenge.
Well, I think what's so interesting and maybe tying together your time at OTPP with your time at Hoop and just differentiating vastly between the Canadian pension ethos and the model relative to most of what you see on the US side. I would imagine with your 9 years at Hoop, just keeping you interested is part of the challenge, that folks like you are constantly thinking about markets from a complex way, thinking about new strategies. And this is where I'd love for you to just help us understand a little bit how Hoop thinks about risk management and taking risk, of course, on behalf of its constituent pensioners, and how different that is, let's just say, from the prototypical US pension fund.
Before we begin, let me state that Hoop, or Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan, so we're the pension plan for frontline workers. So there's over 350,000 workers. So I think first I should thank them for their frontline work and their service. So these are people that are putting themselves at risk, help communities battle COVID, and I'm proud to be able to provide them with a pension, a good pension. Actually, it's a really good pension for their retirement. And for those that don't know, like Hoop is $110 billion. We're 120% funded, a defined benefit plan, and our 10-year return is over 11% annualized. That is something that I'm proud to be a part of. And when you look at kind of the difference of, well, not only Canadian pension plans versus US pension plans and the hedge fund community, because that really is the major players that we're playing, along with some asset managers as well. But I was at a hedge fund, so I'll start with there. When I was at National Bank running an internal hedge fund, I was trying to make money, and I'm trying to trade against other smart people, other smart desks, other smart institutions, and I'm trying to be better at investing than they are. So I'm competitive. I wanted to make money and I wanted to be better than the rest. However, when I look back at it, I wasn't really creating any social value. I made money, I got paid well, and I can use that money, that bonus, to improve the lives of my family and the community. However, personally, the work was a little bit hollow. At Hoop, so I'm not just an asset manager, I'm one person part of the team, but I'm talking as if I do a lot, but I'm helping to manage the liabilities too. I have to be mindful of the downside risks and liquidity. And in order to do that, we have to evolve our liability-driven investing approach. So at a pension plan, I'm investing to deliver the pension promise. I'm making sure that the healthcare workers in Ontario have a good pension for their retirement. And that is fulfilling to me. And I'm thankful that my CEO, Jeff Wendling, and CIO, Michael Whistle, they trust me and have invested in me so that I can be a part of it. I think that kind of gives a bit of an indication. I mean, I can go a little bit into kind of the differences between the Canadian pension plans and the U.S. hedge funds community, if that's okay.
Yeah, well, I thought what was just something you'd be in a great position to comment on is just the unique, what I would say is extremely sophisticated risk management approach, both on the defensive and offensive side, that has long been pursued by Canadian pensions. Perhaps it's while being, of course, very risk aware and protecting that pensioner capital, but also utilizing the long datedness of some of the capital to be an offsetting part of the risks in the market and taking on risks that others are not able to bear over a longer period of time.
That's right. And you hit on something that's really important. I mean, being part of a pension plan, Canadian pension plan like Hoop, the focus really is on the long term. You have to have, you know, not only a diversified portfolio, strong risk management, a strong investment team, but the ability to focus on the long term, not worry as much about the short term gyrations, is important. Because in my opinion, if you're smart, you put on good trades that have well-defined loss scenario, then you may not be right. You're not in charge of how the results unfold. So you might have some short-term losses, but all of these things are correlated with long-term success, provided that you're good and you're passionate and basically you know what you're doing. And that is really it. And when you look at the Canadian pension plans, they really are more similar to the U.S. hedge funds rather than the U.S. pension plan. Part of the reason is up here in Canada, we have the ability to pay professional wells, and we trade strategies and products more like the U.S. hedge funds. That long-term view and the ability to hire smart people, pay well, and trade for the long-term using derivatives or sophisticated strategies and products allows us to be top-performing. And when you look at Hoop, Hoop is not only a top-performing pension plan in Canada, we're probably top-performing in the world. I don't know what number that might be. I'm going to guess something like 97th percentile, 98th percentile, but an 11% annualized return for 10 years is really something that everyone here should be proud of.
That's fantastic. Just to run with this differentiation with the traditional U.S. pension and the similarities to some of the risk orientation that the typical U.S. hedge fund might take, insofar as it being similar to an organization like Hoop. You'd mentioned getting started in 1998. And of course, this is one of the earliest real big vol blowups with long-term capital. And I'm just recalling something that was written about LTCM back in 97. And look, one of their favorite strategies was selling long-dated Vega with this view that realized is 10, you're selling 3-year and 5-year at the money vol at 15 plus, and that's a big spread, and we can warehouse this and risk manage this. And over time, we're going to wind up on top. And of course, these days, I think the long-dated part of the vol curve, the long-dated part of the surface, it's just a dangerous, in some ways, place to be because sometimes there's vast amounts of illiquidity. That's where I'd love to start the conversation, is just to get you to reflect a little bit on long-dated S&P vol, the kind of periods of time where you saw things that you were kind of struck by, where trades just either imploded or where there was successful opportunities to capture something that maybe was dislocated versus the vol fundamentals, as it were. Reflect back for us a little bit on just some of your experience in that portion, the long-dated portion of the S&P vol market.
I mean, the long-dated portion of the S&P, and I'm talking long-dated being kind of beyond 5 years, kind of 7 to 10 years, that market is pretty much gone in terms of the liquidity. And that kind of happened after 2008. Volatility products and variance products became a little bit more sophisticated outside of the vanilla options in order to trade Vega, which occurred for a long time from like the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but kind of in around the early 2000s or so is really when volatility and variance products kind of picked up. And they picked up not only in index, but also in single stocks, and they picked up globally. But 2008 was really where hedge funds, life insurance companies, pension plans, people that were on the wrong side of the market blew up, and the illiquidity forced them to kind of not trade this kind of product again. There were a lot of features that were good about it, such as like when you trade Vega using a variance product versus Vega versus a strip of options. With the options, you're going to have to delta trade under the position in order to capture the realized versus implied variance spread. But with variance as a whole, it's just an OTC product. You don't have to trade your Vega. So it's a much cleaner way to do it. Your Vega always exists. But there are some negatives. The negatives are you kind of have this uncapped sort of payout. With a strip of options, you move outside of your strip, you lose your Vega. So if the market is at 2,500 on the S&P, which maybe it was back then, and it falls to 1,200, at 1,200, you don't have any options down at that level, so you've lost your Vega. But with a variance swap, you have Vega everywhere. And not only when the market falls from 2,500 to 1,200, do you still have your Vega. Your Vega actually explodes a lot higher because vols have increased quite a lot. And there's an uncapped nature to it. So that really caused a lot of pain in a lot of players. But at the same time, if you go back to derivative usage, Buffett was a large participant and made a ton of money in 2008 when markets were stressed. Volatility levels were high and dislocations were abound. And in 2008, or just afterwards, so did Hoop. I mean, we implemented a very large and very profitable strategy using derivatives to take advantage of the market environment. I wasn't here at Hoop at the time, but Jim Cohane, who was our previous CEO, and Jeff Wendling, who's our current CEO, were here and were instrumental, along with others like Steven Anderson, to put the strategy on. But we traded 10-year Vega on the S&P at kind of like 35 vol level, roughly. I mean, some clips might have been even higher at like 38 vol. And that was for 10 years. So you're expecting the S&P to move by more than 2% a day, every day, for more than 10 years, for almost 10 years, which was a ridiculous number. When you go back to the worst 5 years on the S&P, and they don't even have to be consecutive years. So you can pick, say, 1998 was a really bad year in terms of high realized volatility. And so it was 2001. And so it was 2003, for example, but you put the five non-consecutive, the worst realized years on the S&P, it still doesn't hit 25. I haven't rerun this with COVID, but I'm assuming that kind of still holds. So if you're able to sell something at like 35, chances are you're going to click about 10 points of profit, if not more. But you do also have to deal with the fact that it's a 10-year trade. So in those first 2 years, you're going to have some massive mark-to-market because even if 35 was irrational, because maybe 25 should have been the right number, 35 was irrational because of everything, all the market dynamics going on, people were getting squeezed and people had to get out. That squeeze could make 35 go to 45. And so you will suffer losses in the short term. But if you have the ability to hold on for the long term, which is one of Hoop's competitive advantages, you will make money. So, and we were able to do that. So I hope that gives sense.
I think that's a great example of just sometimes how dislocated prices can get from some version of value. And I think in the grand scheme of optionality, value is some version of carry, implied versus realized. We can backtest trades. And I'm recalling very much that high trade in 10-year variance. It was, as you said, after Buffett was rumored to be unwinding that big block of Vega. I'm going to put it around July of 2010. The flash crash was fresh in everybody's mind. Greece was starting to really spill over into just the general pricing of risk. And there was obviously a massive short squeeze. And I'm remembering one of the stats, I think, I did this myself, is if you took actually the 10 years of just the worst days on an up or down basis, just realized days, that 10 years would have been 44 on a realized basis. So that's just every single of the worst days, the top 2,520 worst days, you would have lost a couple of vols. It was staggering.
These were almost free money. But don't let anyone, I don't know if the podcast goes around. I didn't say that.
Right. But this is, I think, a good way to pivot just to this general idea of risk recycling, of trying to be near the hoop, literally, when some dislocation occurs and having the capital and the balance sheet to kind of tough it out. When you do have dislocations like a variant swap dislocation, it doesn't get there unless something is really malfunctioning. The people that are typically sellers have turned buyers. There is a rush to cover. There's clearly a shortage of capital into the strategy. And of course, that becomes the edge. I was just hoping you could step back and help us think about that if you're in a position to try to almost play a role in a market repairing itself by providing capital into an environment where there's clearly a shortage, how do you balance the, okay, this opportunity looks great versus it could look even better tomorrow or the next day? What's that balance in terms of trying to get in to a dislocation but not getting in too early?
It's a tough question. I think you're kind of focusing on what is your framework for thinking about risk. You could look at the US dollar as kind of a safe haven. You could look at equity levels and valuations, credit spread, correlations, the yield curve, beta, the amount of complacency that's in the market, price of optionality. What I will say is that one of the biggest lessons, like in recent history, is that it pays to kind of hedge the tail or gap risk that occurs more often than expected. So if you're able to play from a position of strength, you'll benefit. So, and that's the objective of a tail fund, is to preserve capital during periods of economic expansion and then generate high positive returns in a worsening economic environment. But in general, a tail fund will have a long-term negative expected return. So they're a risk mitigating tool that balance risk and they allow investors to be in a relative position of strength. But that's something that is really valuable. If you're a pension plan, as an example, and you're able to cut off the minus 20% year, you might have to pay a little bit to do that. But the ability to cut off a minus 20% is really beneficial from a long-term compounding view. So you're able to compound your positive much better for a small cost. And I think that really is kind of the overarching strategy. I mean, there's other considerations you'll have. What's the liquidity? What's your solvency? What's your balance sheet at? Fortunately, Hoop has a very strong balance sheet and a team that manages it really, really well. But actually, let me just build a little bit on this concept of kind of tail or long volatility. So assets such as long volatility or long duration bonds and commodities, including precious metal and gold, so they've historically provided significant negative correlation to equities and have historically have acted as portfolio diversifiers. So gold and equity volatility historically have been considered net zero or negative expected return assets. But bonds were a positive expected return, negative correlation asset. So when you combine bonds with equities, portfolios were able to generate alpha, a volatility adjusted return in excess of kind of an equity cash pairing return. But with rates close to their lowest, like historical lower bounds, like they were 6 months ago, bonds no longer have the ability to generate a significant rally should equities sell off. So therefore, bonds are unable to serve that traditional role of being a portfolio diversifier and being negatively correlated. So another risk is that when yields are low, like I said, or at least they were 6 months ago, there's little upside for bonds, but they remain significant downside should yields head higher. So all investors and all algorithms really learned to trade one side of this market. I mean, since we've pretty much both you and me have been in this market, we've seen falling rates and falling inflation. And that goes back to the 80s, 90s. And so this end of this regime is going to be very painful for bonds and for equities. So this risk parity, the 60-40 portfolio that has served investors so well, won't going forward. And you see it this year, that bond equity correlation flips. The typical risk parity strategy falters. So you have to have the tools to deal with this possibility. I mean, that's part of the reason personally I advocate to be a little bit short equities, short bonds, long volatility, because central banks are pulling liquidity out of the markets. When you look at all trades, all asset classes, you're either long vol or short vol. You're either long risky assets or you're short risky assets. And when there was quantitative easing and cash was available, that was a time to be generally to be short vol or long risky assets to some extent. And now that central banks are pulling liquidity out of the market, I think you want to be the other way. And you can see it with the equity fixed income as that correlation has flipped. You want to reallocate instead of your equity fixed income buckets. Maybe you want to allocate to equity commodities because those asset classes now become more negatively correlated. You need to consider how to trade from a position of strength so you're able to take advantage of situations, play from that position of strength when others are not, when others are dumping positions at almost any price. That's when I want to make sure Hoop is in a strong position so we're able to take advantage of those dislocations, that we're also not in a similar situation. We're also worried about liquidity or worried about losses, and we're unable to take that long-term view where our judgment gets clouded because of short-term losses. So I think that's kind of my views on how to look at kind of these dislocations that occur.
Well, you make some really important points there. And you're talking about this regime change, perhaps from a very disinflationary environment that persisted for a long period of time to something that's clearly very different. And then the interaction between stock and bond prices has noticeably changed. Duration as this free, magical, positive carry hedge is no longer, certainly not consistent. One of the stats I've been following is looking at incidents where both the Qs and the TLT both experienced a down 150 basis point day on the same day. Over the last decade, it's happened 13 times, and remarkably, five of them have been in 2022. 10 of them are post-pandemic. So it's obvious what's happened here. And this is where I wanted to go in terms of just trying to think about hedge construction, trying to conserve valuable premium. If just buying puts and being long the market worked all the time, everybody would do it. But it's very clear that vol can be expensive for long periods of time. So just insofar as stocks versus bonds, you and I have talked a little bit about strategies like or trades like rate contingent puts, where you've got a put on the S&P, but it's contingent on yields rising. And that's at least previously antithetical to the risk on, risk off environment. And so it clears the market cheaper. Love for you to just talk about what you see there in terms of opportunities, how the pricing has evolved in this more inflationary environment. Tell us more about that light exotic trade.
So in order to continue to add alpha to portfolios, you need to look for negatively correlated assets with flat to positive expected return profiles. So like we said, one such option is a multi-asset, long volatility, long convexity strategy. And I also said it's personal view that you want to be short some equity, short some bonds, and long volatility as central banks pull the liquidity out of the market. You can combine all three of those calls into one structure, which is an equity put contingent on rates higher. So that gets you short equities, it gets you short bonds, and it also is long vol. Now it plays the correlation between equities and fixed income. And at Hoop, we traded these options, kind of like a layer on option. They're highly convex. And we traded them a while ago. So back when the correlation was more in your favor, it's not as much in your favor because it's kind of shifted to being more positive now. But it still offers value. So it's still there. But the ways to play kind of to reduce your bond portfolio, you can go outright and sell your bonds, or you can buy pairs as an example, and that will reduce your bond allocation. For equities, you can sell your equities down, or you can buy equity puts. And if you do the equity put contingent on rates higher, you could get a discount that was massive. I'll give you them about 6 months ago. I haven't traded it in about 6 months, but if you looked at like a 2-year 80% put that might've cost you X, whatever the number is, say it was 6% as an example, and that number is probably wrong, but let's just suppose it was 6%, adding a contingent of rates being higher, and say you pick the 10-year rate being higher by the at-the-money forward level plus 25 beeps or something like that, you would probably trade that same exotic or light exotic put at probably something like an 80% discount to that regular vanilla equity put. So there's a lot of bang for the buck for those options. Now, not to say you're going to be right. It's a contingent, so you kind of need both legs to pan out and within your time period that you're playing. So there's a high probability you're going to be wrong on one of the legs or both of the legs, and you're going to lose your premium, but that's why it's so cheap. You're going to spend 20 cents to make a dollar, and that's a really attractive payout. And if you're right, you're going to make a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting about that one is that because the risk on, risk off regime was so persistent and strong for that period of time, if you're just running the correlation between stocks and bonds, you're going to come up with a minus 50% realized correlation during that disinflationary period. And so for a dealer to price it at minus 30, even though on a forward-looking basis, the set of inflation facts on the ground may be creating something where it could flip to zero or positive, that's what makes it so interesting. What about just stepping back and thinking about other areas of risk premium that when you look at are explainable sources of excess return that you can look at and say, I'm able to step into something here where, again, there's a market shortfall, there's a capital shortfall, and I'm getting paid to absorb risk at a level I think is more than commensurate with the actual risk. What do those other circumstances look like these days?
It's a bit difficult because, you know, investing in life sciences is a bit of an art, but I'll say that you want to look at where you have an edge. Where we have an edge is kind of with our balance sheet, with the ability to trade derivatives, and then look at the flows to see where other participants might be offside or have views that are too priced to perfection. I'll give you one example of a trade that we did a little while ago, which I thought was great, and it probably still exists today. Actually, it does still exist today. And then I can even step back and talk to you about kind of 2005, 2007. I think this is a great example with CDS and how these dynamics play out. But if you look at an equity put, they can be quite expensive, especially now. Like, I mean, the VIX was at 20 on Wednesday and Thursday and then moved up to 30 like this morning with the market sell-off. I would have said that the VIX or equity vols were cheap, especially relative to fixed income vol. So with vols expensive now, equity puts are probably expensive or likely expensive or at least more expensive than they were. But you can always, if you can't add a contingency with rates, you can do other things to make that cheaper. So you can add a window to that vanilla put. So you can buy, for example, an S&P 4,000 strike put, and a regular December S&P 4,000 strike put might cost you, say, $170. But if you add a knockout window to, say, June of 4,000, you could probably cheapen that put to half the value. So you're playing the dynamic of short-term vols being elevated to long-term vols. That dynamic, so that shift, which is probably the case right now. And you also have time on your side. And you're also playing like a kind of a short skew or short vol within the shorter term to June, but you're doing it in a limited loss profile way. So worst comes to worst, you're not going to be short a massive amount of uncapped Vega and lose hundreds of millions of dollars. You're just going to lose whatever premium you spent. And as long as that's manageable, you're able to keep on playing that game. And the more you play that game, the more the odds will kind of be in your favor. This conversation actually kind of reminds me of 2005 and 2007 to some extent. Both of us were there. We've traded for 20 plus years and we both probably have war stories. But if you go back, if you look at 2005 to 2007, those were years that the market didn't do much at all. Equity and risky assets, they slowly grinded higher in general. And volatility levels and credit spreads were extremely low. And I remember back in 2005 and 6, looking at Fannie Mae and Bank of America credit spreads, and the cost of five-year protection was extremely cheap, 25 beeps or so, roughly in that range. And this seemed too cheap to me. And the CDS levels, in my opinion, were priced to perfection. Everyone thought that there's no way that these credit spreads, these companies could default, that they would widen. And in my opinion, I wanted to buy protection as I thought the risk to return or the gains to potential losses were asymmetric in my favor. And I knew credit, I traded credit. However, I wasn't trading credit in and out all day long. So what I did at the time was I actually went and I asked my network of smart credit traders to hear their thoughts, to check, am I missing anything? So I asked credit traders at other banks, at other hedge funds, and capital structure arbitrage players their thoughts. And everyone, and I mean absolutely everyone, thought I was insane to piss away 25 beeps per annum on good money, on companies that were good and wouldn't default. And most people I spoke to were actually short this protection and picking up a tiny spread to clip a tiny yield. And honestly, I was taken aback by this. Like all the smart credit people I knew thought that buying protection on Fannie Mae and Bank of America was nuts. I didn't do anything at first, but this just sat with me for weeks. And back then, 2005, 2006, you know, markets really didn't move. So it could sit with me for a long time and levels didn't change, but I couldn't shake the fact that there was a huge potential payoff if things weren't perfect. So going against kind of that crowd. So after a while, I did buy protection on Bank of America and on Fannie Mae and on Freddie Mac. And I also executed sub-senior credit spreads on them too. And I did quite a few hundred million notional. And over 2006 and 2007, or the early part of 2007, some of 2005, nothing happened. And I did piss away premium. That was okay because it was such a small amount that it was manageable for me. But then in late 2007, that's when kind of the cracks emerged and credit started to widen and things started to spiral out of control. And then you had the great financial crisis of 2008. And that's when I made a lot of money. Like, I remember the high print for me closing out Bank of America CDF on a portion of it was 375 beeps, so about a 10 bagger. So I lost money for 2 years, yet my loss potential was small and manageable and enabled me to hold on and then yield some fantastic profits in the end. So the lesson for me there was, like, no one knows what's going to happen in the markets, but if you're smart, if you put on good trades, you have well-defined risk or loss limits, then over time, like I said, hard work and intelligence does pay off with patience. So you don't control the results, and everyone's going to have short-term losses, but hard work, passion, the ability to learn, ability to adapt are definitely correlated with long-term success.
I think what keeps us interested and enthusiastic about chasing these markets is that there are periods, and perhaps hindsight is maybe not 2020, but it certainly helps to look backwards. And you think about that 25 basis point of premium on 5-year CDS versus the fundamentals of leverage that had taken hold of those business models. We all know about the 35 times leverage that was pretty much shared across the banks late 2006 versus that really diminutive level of credit protection. It's just hugely incongruous. I'm thinking again about, it's as late as August of last year, where 2 and 5 year US interest rates are about as low as they could be. And the vol is as low as it could be as well. And so you have this emerging inflation fundamental that's clearly at some point going to drive bond yields higher and necessitate a Fed response. And yet the combination of low rates and incredibly low vol, because the Fed was so big on forward guidance, is just very inconsistent with what's happening. I think that's what keeps us all very interested in markets.
In hindsight, that was another slam dunk trade to kind of, like, 2 years ago, if you bought pairs in fixed income in US markets, even European markets, maybe even the Japanese markets even, like, you bought a long-term 5-year, 5-year, 10-year, 10-year, like, way out of the money striked pair, you would have made money hand over fist. Like, you probably would have made 3-5 times the premium that you spent. And again, if you were wrong, you only lost the premium that you spent. Very asymmetric. I don't want to make it sound like we're only making money. I mean, to be quite honest and frank, like, when COVID happened, like, after 2008, I actually thought that was the worst I would ever see in my investing career. And then we had COVID, and that was kind of thrown at me, and it was very shocking, the market sell-off that was there, and the bounce back was equally shocking. And that really also did change the investing environment. And we ourselves at Hoop also, our alpha program actually suffered losses during COVID, yet they were manageable. It wasn't detrimental to our plan. And that's part of the investing game. But it really did also ask us to refocus and ask some core questions. What was our balance in return? How do we rank or measure solvency, safety, liquidity, leverage, things that you've touched on? And determine, are we being adequately compensated for the risk that we're taking? That really is a core question. Like you said, selling variance at 38 when maybe the worst case untheoretical loss is 44 sounds like a really good trade. But, you know, selling variance at 20 when your mark to market can go to 35 probably is something you don't want to do. So by asking these questions, refocusing our alpha platform, we've shifted more into alternatives. We kind of reduced our tail correlations, and now we're positioned better to buy into crisis situations and position better for the long term, like I said, which is our focus. So we talked about volatility. Like, there's two trades in the market, long volatility and short volatility. But the thing to keep in mind also is that volatility brings opportunity. And I want to be able to make sure that Hoop is always in a position of strength to take advantage of these kind of economic and financial turmoil situations that occur.
You referenced the pandemic and the shock that was March of 2020, the incredible, incredible surge in volatility and the unfortunate demise of capital that was engaged in many tail strategies, some of which did badly and some of which just were carried out completely. I'm curious, because we've talked a little bit about some OTC derivative structures. You're, in that case, facing a bank on a bilateral basis. But what are the lessons from a liquidity standpoint in terms of the OTC derivatives marketplace versus, let's say, the listed space that came out of March of 2020? Any repurposing of kind of how you thought about exposure as a function of that drawdown?
It's interesting. Like when I came to Hoop, which has been roughly 9 years now, Hoop traded derivatives 99% in OTC land. So we always had very good systems to determine not only what was the credit rating of the counterparties we were facing, how much exposure we had, how much offsetting exposure we had between different parties or products and parties between that. But it's always something that you have to pay attention to, this liquidity factor and managing your balance sheet, because again, that's where the squeeze can happen. The other thing also at Hoop is that we're very concentrated in the capital markets versus the private markets, relative to our peers, that is. So our peers will have more private than we do in terms of an asset mix. But that also allowed us to be more of a position of strength during COVID, because there were some counterparties during COVID that had private assets, didn't have enough public market assets, couldn't generate the cash that they needed or liquidity that they needed at the time, and then they had to go tap kind of the Bank of Canada or issue paper or sell things at a discount. And then after they sold things at a discount, when the markets ripped back, they're unable to participate on the way back up because they're not fast enough to deal with that kind of re-leverage into kind of risky assets. So you kind of get caught on kind of, it's kind of like a short gamble position. You get caught both ways. The market whips down, you have to sell. The market whips up, you didn't buy enough and you take some more losses and then you buy at the high. It's a tough situation to be in. We've always had very, very good collateral management, risk management, balance sheet management functions at Hoop, which has been a core competency for us, an edge for us.
When you think about the results from, let's just stay within the equity tail selling universe, people can do it in various ways. You could sell straddles, you could sell variant swaps, you could be engaged in some form of complex risk recycling that the street's always encouraging counterparties to take a look at. You could do the mini trade, the butterfly, sell the straddle, buy the strangle to protect. When you think about the lessons from the degree of drawdown in March of 2020, and then of course the snapback, what does it tell you about just how those tail strategies are most effectively oriented? And then how should we maybe re-examine the vulnerabilities in light of an event like March of 2020?
It was a situation where correlations go to one. All the risk recycling trades that the banks were pushing, they're all kind of the same form. They're short vol in some form. Either you're short correlation, your short gamma, your short skew, some combination of those. And when the shit hits the fan, you're going to take losses. There is a right price to trade everything. So were you being adequately compensated at the price you traded at? Maybe you were, maybe you weren't. But also in the worst case scenario, something that you can't even fathom, what is going to be your loss scenario, your downside risk? Is it more than you can bear? And if so, maybe you don't trade it, or you trade a smaller portion, or you restructure it such that it's not an unlimited sort of downside. I mean, it was in the papers, but without naming names, I mean, there was a volatility strategy out up north that was, again, in hindsight, picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. It was a strategy that sold uncapped variance and bought capped variance and collected a small premium, which normally would get paid until something like COVID happened, and then the losses became uncapped and large, and they did. Those are the type of trades you want to avoid. Like I said, cutting off that -10, -20% on an annual basis, but over the long term, is extremely valuable, extremely, extremely valuable, especially for a long-term focused pension plan.
Well, let's shift to contemplating some of the other big tail events that we've experienced post-COVID. We've seen remarkable moves in things like oil from negative 35 on the front month future to something closer to 130. Crazy, crazy moves. But in single stock land in the US, we had this meme episode starting in January of 2021, culminating with GameStop in the 500s and the vol went to 800 or so. Just some wildly outlandish behavior in terms of the right tail. I'd love to hear you talk out loud about what you guys were looking at that point in time, perhaps how did it overlay versus your book? Were there any trades you saw to do on the back of that? Walk us through your rendering of the meme craze.
Like you said, it was early 2021, and it was stocks like GameStop and then AMC that had rocketed higher, and they received a lot of media attention. Let's take a look at like why this happened. What was the scenario? So it was largely due to an army of retail investors, somewhat coordinated with an anti-establishment angst. So they were buying shares and they were buying short-term out-of-the-money call options. And those have a high degree of convexity or gamma, as we say in the industry. And on the other side were large hedge funds that were short these names and suffered large losses as a stock like GameStop went to 50 to 500 and AMC went from $2 or $3 to 30. I think it might have even hit as high as like 70. And short squeezes have happened before, like silver in 1979 with the Hunt brothers or Volkswagen in 2008. And they'll happen again. But what were the events that led to this event unfolding? There were a few factors. There were the investing platforms like Robinhood that offered fractional share participation and zero commission. There were also governments and the Fed that handed out stimulus checks and access to cheap money. And there was COVID. And I think this is the big one, is COVID was the great unequalizer. So it created the dynamics for inequality to worsen. The rich got richer and the rest felt further left behind. And they were priced out of the housing market, for example. And this led to a rise of populism and angst. Now, yeah, how did this affect Hoop directly? To be honest, it really didn't. So it didn't affect Hoop directly. However, it was a market dynamic that we had to pay attention to. So if anything, what it did was it focused a spotlight on short interest and related metrics, and it focused us to be better to understand which counterparties were involved in these names, and it focused us on additional risk management. These were kind of the areas of focus for us. On an individual name basis, it wasn't something we were directly involved in.
Does an episode like that, even if it doesn't overlap with your exposures, is it something that the team steps back and say, boy, even with a mindset that invites the improbable, these moves are so outlandishly out of bounds that perhaps something else is afoot here? And again, even if it's unrelated nominally to our current portfolio, we've got to step back and perhaps appreciate that things are moving and moving fast in markets. Is there some takeaway from some of these moves that the team had?
I mean, there was. I wrote an internal paper at that time, just kind of outlining my thoughts and kind of how did we get to this point? Then not only what are the next things that could happen, but what are the second and third order effects? And that really is where traders really have to kind of concentrate on. Not what next is going to happen, but what's going to happen after that and then after that. And so in my mind, it was that large hedge funds, come out the Melvin Capital and other large institutions were going to suffer large losses. And these things don't happen in isolation where they're contained. So they could spiral out of control. I'm not saying I want them to, but we just have to be cognizant of that possibility occurring. The natural inclination is I don't fully understand what is going on and what those second and third next steps are in the markets or the effects are going to be. So the logical thing to do is then to just kind of pare back risk a little bit and just say, as things unfold, if I don't have a strong opinion, I'll just pare back risk, watch them unfold. And if there is an opportunity to take advantage of where I'm confident, I haven't stuck out my neck foolishly and now in a position in a bad place where I'm unable to participate in a juicy opportunity that reveals itself down the road. You always want to be smart.
As you step back and just look at the totality of risk out there, risk is always evolving. We were talking about 2005 and 6 and 7, and that episode ultimately was about risk in the U.S. banking system and leverage in the housing market. And these risks are different. There's a new set of them, but they are different. If I was to look at your dashboard of risks and try to understand where you're gathering signals from across different asset classes or geographies, are there a couple that are front and center for you now that you're paying a special attention to?
Given that I kind of was in IT and math and stats, I always kind of had a little bit of a quant bent to me. Not that I'm a quantitative investor, but I'd like to consider myself savvy enough that I can use kind of models to pick up all the data to see what's kind of like a little bit out of whack. And it might be rational or might not be, but it allows me to kind of scan the whole universe and figure out what might not make sense or something to pay attention to. So I do look at kind of like all the asset classes, all the geographies that are there, short-term, long-term, skew, vol, beta, all these things from before that we kind of touched on. But I mean, front and center for me is inflation. I've talked about this for probably 2 years or so. It's pretty clear, at least to me, it is that inflation is going to remain persistent. And look, everyone is already experiencing higher food and energy prices. And we saw what happened with Arab Springs and the effect of kind of higher cost of living, whether it's food or energy or anything, it could lead to more social unrest. And that leads to more sanctions or supply chain disruptions. And that can lead to more social unrest and it can lead to wars and all these things we have to be very cognizant of. So that everyone's experiencing higher food and energy prices. Additionally, we have a very tight labor market and central bank tightening. So, I mean, fortunately for us at Hoop, we've been a little bit ahead of this, reducing our bonds, reducing nominal bonds and increasing inflation-sensitive assets and real return bonds and allocating the privates and alternatives and diversifying our portfolio and very diligent in our risk management. But you just have to be cognizant that inflation is also about psychology. And the risk is that the academics will get it wrong. Like I said, I don't want to see this happen, but you just have to be cognizant of this possibility. The Fed now is much less able to ease into every slowdown or asset class decline. So right now, global central banks are expected to drain about $2 trillion of liquidity from the markets, and the Fed is about half of that. Quantitative tightening is a limiting factor for risky assets like stocks to appreciate. Again, just in my opinion. I don't want it to sound like all doom and gloom, so I'll throw in a positive out there too. I'll say that I think Canadian stocks will outperform U.S. stocks over the next few years. I'll leave it at that.
Nice. It is fascinating. And it maybe is the case that the stock market decline itself is part of the Fed's tightening. There's so much discussion around this concept of financial conditions. Seems like a fancy way of combining rates, credit spreads, and the S&P in an index. But perhaps a weaker stock market is itself a part of crimping the demand that maybe is at least on the demand side of solving for inflation. Well, let's finish with this. I'd be curious because you have a very active mind for thinking about markets and risk and trade construction. What's on the docket for you and team in terms of things you're looking at? You started the call by talking about some of the additional items that are within your remit in terms of insurance and so forth. What are the things that have you excited about in terms of investigating?
I mean, in terms of capital markets, I think what's still very exciting is the fact that fixed income vol seems to be very, very highly elevated relative to the other asset classes. If you look at kind of the MOVE index is extremely high relative to equity vol. There's something like pricing in for fixed income kind of like 10 beats a day of MOVE for the next year or so, which seems really, really high. And that hasn't flowed into FX markets, in my opinion. And I think as economies become more focused inward on themselves, less globalization, these relationships that we've seen in the past within FX pairs will deviate. So there'll be greater movement. We're seeing a little bit of that. I mean, the yen has gone kind of, well, holistic over the last little while for some other reasons as well too. But I think there's a lot of value in FX volatility. I've always thought FX volatility was very cheap, but you know, you can buy a euro, US dollar, 2 year Vega at like 6. And the problem was, is that it realized 5 and you lost a vol on it. But now it feels like it's not 6, maybe it's 7 now. But I think that 7, sure, you could still lose a point or something like that. But I think there's a chance that that 7 becomes a 12 or realizes 12 is a lot higher than it was from before. So I think there's a lot of value there. I think there's a lot of value in FX. Well, in fixed income vol, rolling into other asset classes. FX seems a logical choice, but then it also rolls into kind of credit and it rolls into equities. Like, I mean, should the MOVE index be priced where it is? And the VIX, well, as of last week was 20 and now it was, like I said, 30 this morning, but still, that still feels like a dislocation to me. So I think there's opportunities within these cross asset pockets. And then the other opportunities are there was, like I said, I have kind of insurance linked securities under me. There's a lot of opportunities in terms of the fact that there were large losses last year with a lot of catastrophe events that did occur. And so the capital allocation to the space has been light, which is increasing spreads. So deals are getting done much slower than they have before. So I think you might be wrong again. There might be more catastrophes again that cause losses, but you're just going to get paid more than you were last year, and that's more than it was the year before. So at some point, you're just going to have to say that I'm getting adequately compensated. I still may lose money, but it was the right trade to do. I think we're in that situation now. And then on the external manager's side, we are looking more at innovative strategies, things that are a little bit more outside the box, smaller allocations. That's the external manager's team, but we're doing that in conjunction with the other teams that were very strong investing teams. There's people involved in it in equities, private equities, credit, and we're making allocations to some very, I'd say, unique areas of investing, small allocations. So things that are never good to lose money, but it's something that if we were to lose money, it's something that we can deal with. And I think it's better for us to invest in these spaces and learn rather than to be caught off-footed and play defense when these technologies or certain areas, even if something like crypto or digital assets, if this becomes more commonplace and infiltrates the financial world more, I'd rather be ahead of the curve than behind the curve. So those are some of the things that are kind of like on my plate or I'm looking at.
Great to learn about those. And of course, the need to be invested and generate some form of risk-adjusted return is not going away. But the challenges with constructing a portfolio in which the elements don't bear some common driving factor, in other words, that aren't as correlated, as critical as ever and as difficult as ever. So looking at things like insurance risk premiums that are just less correlated than stocks, bonds, and FX and credit, I think is pretty darn interesting.
It's a beautiful point you made there. Sorry to cut you off, but you want these orthogonal returns. Insurance-linked securities is totally uncorrelated to equities and fixed income. So you can add that. If there's a risk premium, you're going to add that on top of whatever other risk premiums you're added. And if you have a well-diversified alpha platform, which I believe we do have, and actually the proof is in the pudding, like in January of this year, equities were down, bonds were down. We had one of our best months ever. I mean, it's a small sample, but it kind of helped prove out the concept that we've kind of built a well-diversified, market-neutral alpha platform. And the more and more of these strategies you can put together that are orthogonal, the better it is for you. And I think there are a lot of opportunities for that. It is difficult.
Well, it's been great to gather your perspectives, both on some of the past vol events in which we've lived and just on the here and now of pricing of risk and how Hoop is working on behalf of its constituents. So Puneet, it's been great to spend the hour and thanks for being a guest on the Alpha Exchange.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again and catch you next time.